So I get to announce Art's speech, or talk, serene melancholy, spiritual longing, and resistance to truth. That's a relatively rare event that Art does a presentation. I've heard him say a couple of times that he prefers to engage in lively dialogue with people.
Bodies.
If you guys have never been to a confrontation session, you'll know what I'm talking about. Go to his. Right. So since most of you know Art, I'm going to truncate his biography just a little bit, but I want to say that he's a spiritual marathoner. He, at the age of 33, ran across Richard Rose, and he plodded on for 25 years until he finally had a breakthrough where he discovered where he... And so I've heard him say he discovered what he was at the core of his being. So less than 2 years ago, he moved from Pittsburgh to Ocala, which is relatively close to where I live. And I've had the privilege of working with him on a self-inquiry group together. And I consider him a teacher and a good friend. Some things that I admire about Art. One, he's a very astute psychologist and studier of mentalities. I've seen that a lot in the self-inquiry group. He's very clear on his bias. If you listen closely, you hear him say, "To me, it makes absolutely no sense that XYZ." Also, I appreciate his continued insistence on clarity and honesty about what one really wants. And though it's a thorn in my side sometimes, I think it's really important. So these days, Art lives La Dolce Vita in Ocala, where he's been known to kayak, work on his garden, write emails, and do a mean line dance. Welcome.
You know me. You know I'm a stickler for doing things in the proper order and stuff like that, and following the all the rules and the, you know, reading book from the first page through to the end without ever looking in between. So I thought, and just thinking about the time of day now. So it's a time of day where it'd be nice to take a little afternoon snooze, and I figure by the time I get through talking, the profundity of it will have you in like a silent stupor, and you won't be able to ask any questions anyway. So I think maybe we could just reverse things a little bit and do the questions first, and then my talk. Is that a good idea?
Novel.
Or arguments.
Sounds like you're putting that to work.
Yep, that's exactly what I have in mind. Yeah, because really what I'm thinking is these people are all asleep. They just want to continue snoozing and have me entertain them. So, if you come here without any questions, what are you doing here, you know? I mean, why are you here this weekend? And what do you want? What are you looking for?
Is this the first question that you got to say?
I'll tell you... Usually I'm a little bit more organized in my talk. I usually have it all on one paper or one set of papers, you know. Today it's sort of like this. But, you know, I've got a perfect excuse because I had my 70th birthday 2 weeks ago or a week ago whenever Tess came over. Where is Tess? When Tess came over to celebrate my birthday. And so I figured it's only going to get worse from here. And I don't care. It's going to be disorganized. Yeah.
Did you always know what you wanted, or was there just an inkling and some sort of curiosity, and what you wanted revealed itself to you as you kind of, you know, felt your way in that direction?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, my life, if I look back, had like three phases of looking for something. And the first phase I call the unconscious phase, objective to be happy. And then the second phase, which kicked off about my senior year of college, was a semi-conscious seeking, and what it was, event a couple of years after I got out of college, but the cold water hit my face in my senior year of college, where I sort of just dreamed of going on indefinitely, become a math professor, and you know, stuff like that. And I realized that I didn't have any great talent for math. I was just doing it by grunt work. And I thought, well, this would be a lie to myself and to any students, you know. So the thought came into my mind back then, oh, my God, I'm going to have to go to work at an 8-to-5 job, 5 days a week for 40 years. And I thought, what a boring prospect. And then a couple years after that, I started having these identity crises every once in a while. I don't know if they occurred a couple times a year, maybe. And I realized I've got everything should make me happy, but it's not doing the trick. And the way I worded it, I was looking for some missing purpose or meaning in my life. And so that was like the second phase of my life. And the third was after I met Richard Rose. And then I would say that then it became sort of a conscious search. And what I was searching for, I was the whole time I was just trying to remove this unhappiness or this feeling of you know, uncertainty or whatever. The feeling didn't change, but my words for it changed. And so eventually I adopted Rose's words for it, which was become the truth. And I remember talking to Boz one time. Where's Boz? And I told you that I'm falling in love with the truth. And it doesn't make any sense, does it, because it's an abstraction, but that's really the way it felt to me. It was like even little things, like I loved people who told the truth. I loved the truth-telling, and I loved trying to be. I wasn't always honest, but I loved when I was honest, I loved that. And so the idea of being in love with some capital T truth, which I had no idea what it was, but just seemed like that made a lot of sense to me.
How did it go with relationships, whether with your wife or your children or whatever,
mm-hmm.
the falling away of, you know, the whole spiel on that?
Yeah, so the relationship with my family definitely fell away. But before that, I had seen very clearly what I really wanted, and it was to become the truth, and that became my priority. And so I wasn't trying to get rid of other things, but that became my priority. And the first solitary retreat I ever did, a light bulb came out in my head, and the words that came with it were, in order for me to have any chance of mental clarity, I needed to go through an extended period of celibacy. And so it turned out that shook my wife's confidence in me, you know, or her belief in our love and things like that. And a year later, she divorced me. And so all that fell away. Rose told me at the time, I mean, after I told him, you know, I'd had a summons to divorce court, he said, the thing is, you should never break the friendship. And so I never felt any blame for her or any anger at her. I was very sorry that was what my actions had caused. Yeah. And then basically my intention was to avoid complicating relationships for the next 25 years, which I did.
Doze off,
yeah.
Do you feel any resonance in Tessa's advice? We've heard that, you know, there's like a psychological writing of the organism that needs to happen. I was thinking of your self-acceptance satori that you've talked about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Does that feel right, that you know, somehow things were playing out so that you became psychologically healthy and then, I don't know,
So my bias, you could say adopted Rose's bias about that psychological self-knowing was beneficial. I don't know whether it would be necessary, you know. I don't know whether what I did was necessary, but in his view was strictly the opposite of Harding's view. Harding thought all psychological self-inquiry was useless. Yeah, but my bias still goes toward the... And I remember reading the story about Ramana Maharshi's realization, then spending the next 3 years in down at Arunachala with people carrying him around because he's in Samadhi all the time, bugs making nests in his body, you know, and people having to feed him, stuff like that. And I remember asking or saying something to Bob Zirgle about that one time. He says, he was an adolescent. He didn't know how to take care of himself. Remember that? But I have, my gut feeling is that what was happening for those 3 years of Samadhi afterwards, he was making up lost time that could have been done before, the psychological stuff, psychological self-knowing. So he apparently ended up with an amazing realization when he was 16 years old, but I don't think his mind would have been prepared for it. And I have an idea that was like makeup work that was being done. So yeah, I definitely recommend anybody to not overlook psychological work, psychological self-knowing, not so much trying to change things, but just getting to know themselves at a psychological level.
Do you feel like there's a cutoff point for that? Because, I mean, it seems like once you kind of open up that can of worms, it seems like it can go on forever. You know, and how is it just a matter of maybe getting to a point where there is a stable acceptance, self-acceptance?
Well,
it's okay, it's good enough.
So based on my experience, Luke, and sort of trying to maybe generalize that, I have a feeling that when you're paring down your self-definition, so that the mind's work is paring down our faulty self-definition as much as possible. And I think the first step in that is detachment from personality. And to me, that's sort of the easy part. The next part, detachment from individuality, is not even in the mind's purview to accomplish. But yeah. So once one has some detachment from personality, maybe there's not much more need to do psychological analysis or psychological observation. I mean, you're going to be watching the mind, and so you don't know ahead of time what you're going to see. But you can turn your head away from stuff that doesn't seem relevant. So if you've seen the same psychological patterns over and over and doesn't seem to, nothing changes, well, probably isn't any great need to keep watching that. Turn your head away from that and see what else comes in.
So what do you think about, like, in the case of like Rose's experience? Because in a way it was triggered by something that from
yeah.
a certain standpoint could be construed as deeply psychological.
Mm-hmm.
An insult to a very primal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I think the mind has to be faced with death for something substantial to occur. So if the reactions to that, so and my feeling is if the reaction, depending on what the mind knows about itself or about what it's not, you could say, what it's about self. So the phase of self-definition will determine the mind's reaction when it's faced with death. So if there's still psychological work to be done, that might prevent a full realization.
What do you mean by that?
I don't know. I've got some examples somewhere in here that I might get around to if you're good. Yeah.
Would you say you know what you are in just the same way that you did when you had your realization? Would you say it's equal still?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I heard somebody ask Rose one time, this was years and years after his realization, are you always back there? And Rose paused a little bit and he said, well, sometimes it's closer and other times farther away. A few years ago I wouldn't have said that, but now I think I know what he was talking about. Yeah, so my feeling is if I were back there, the body wouldn't be alive. You know, the body wouldn't survive that long if the focus didn't come back into the body. Mm-hmm. And the main difference to me is now the mind has a touchstone back where I am, It doesn't need to touch very often, but every once in a while something comes up and it touches back there. I suspect it would, Mike. That's my bias. Is that the so that's like a thorn in the side. Not knowing ourselves, having this. There's two of me, but I don't feel like two, or what. However the mind picks it up. So there's that thorn in the side, and the more attention we give to it, I suspect, the more likely we'll see an opposition that may come along, as opposed to it just slides by and we don't become conscious of it. And I think Rose used to use the analogy of the dog chasing its tail. And so I think that occurs more and more as we get closer to the, you know, we've sort of got some distance from personality, but we're still stuck with individuality. Used to say from hearing about Rose's experience, we all thought we were going to have to be carried out on stretchers if we ever had a breakthrough. But I know in my case, it wasn't traumatic at all. It was just a little breath of relief when what we probably call the ego death occurred. Yeah. So I think a lot of that depends on age, because life does it anyway. It's eroding the ego, and then having been exposed to particulars, you know, if you've been around somebody who's had an absolute realization, I think by osmosis we pick up the fact that there's something deeper there. So, you know, when he came back from back into the mind from his realization, he wondered whether he'd gone insane. And I remember one of my first thoughts was also, I can see now why Rose might have thought he'd gone insane. But I think because we had the experience of being around him, it provided more data for the mind to sort of work with and come to terms with what it now knew.
You mentioned a thorn in the side about not 2 meters.
Yeah.
And so in your books, if I picked it up correctly, one of them is the outward look of awareness, and the other is.
Yeah, that would be one way that consternation might hit the mind, yeah. It could be just me, the observer, and objects of awareness. You know, it could there could be a lot of dichotomies that would be the thorn in the side. Yeah. So I don't assume it's going to come the same way to everybody.
The way you described it, I'm curious why the inward looking wasn't viewed as interior.
Well, because when I observed it in slow motion, I was one or the other at any instant. And at that level, there almost didn't seem to be any interior. The interior was only a memory of what had just occurred an instant before that. And what it was always behind me. So, and if I watched it in slow motion, it would almost be laughable because it would flip back and forth so fast it would almost merge, but never quite. Yeah. Uh-huh. And so I was always behind myself, which is, you know, it's not a very settling ending point. Yeah, so basically, it seems to me like the mind wants to remain asleep, and so it has to be convinced somehow that I'm standing on solid ground. It's not going to be a hole that opens up under me at any instant. And I think contradictions, you know, when you have a belief and something comes along to contradict it, the mind immediately wants to be able to choose one or the other so it can feel it's back on solid ground.
Why did you title your first book Solid Ground?
I don't know. I remember that. I never thought about it. I remember that just came into my head at some point when we needed a title for it. I guess probably when we think about publishing it, Tat was going to publish it. Mm-hmm.
What did you say were some good ways for the mind to get contradictory data?
Relationships. Is that right, Arnima? Working with other people, obviously, you know, like what we're trying to do with the confrontation sessions. And if they work well, you know, it's a friendly thing where the defenses are down enough so that new things can hit us. Mm-hmm. Just hearing yourself eventually when you're making the same complaints over and over for several years.
What do you look at me?
I don't know. There's the color of your shirt that has me. Yeah, so it gets confrontational just to hear ourselves talk. I never liked hearing myself. I used to, the early days of doing confrontation groups, afterwards I'd go out and I'd sit in my car and I'd bang on the steering wheel out of frustration at what a lousy job I was doing and stuff like that. So it was always more confronting trying to be the monitor than trying to, people ask me questions, I was relatively confident about that. I could get a fast answer, you know, from under the gun. Okay, so I procrastinated long enough, haven't I? I don't know. So this is what I started off with. I had a nice logical sequence to start beginning the story and going to the end, and then this is, so I started off, a month ago, whenever I came up with a topic for this talk, and it was initially just the first two parts of it, the serene melancholy, which I think occurred to me because it's November, and so I had the picture of deciduous trees with their leaves fallen, and sort of the sad beauty of this season of year, especially in this part of this hemisphere. And the other part was spiritual longing, which is what I think is the basis of everyone's spiritual search, is just that longing or yearning to become whole, to find love, whatever, you know, however our mind throws words on it. And then somehow the third part attached itself, which, and I think that was probably it. Maybe I was thinking about, well, now what's the end of the story if I'm going to try to say something that has a beginning and an end. And I think that was the idea of the resistance to truth is what people are faced with when they're trying to find the final solution to the problem. And then just within the last week, say, it dawned on me, serene melancholy, spiritual longing, resistance to truth, that's my path. And I've never been particularly fond about talking about my path, and some people have read it, you know, and some people have heard it three times, and it doesn't seem like a very interesting thing for me to do. But I thought, okay, so well, I'll just try to go through my path and pick out certain things that might show some possible progression. And then the other thing, that maybe yesterday or the day before, I looked and I saw that topic for the theme for this meeting was deeper within, and the things I picked out to talk about, several, when I looked through that list, several of them were points of when I felt I had gone deeper within. So I figured, why in the hell not try to get those two things together and talk about that in some sequence that might create some questions or consternation for you, something to chew on. So let me see where I start on this. The first going within experience that I had occurred before I met Mr. Rose, but after I had come across a Zen group that was meeting at Ohio State University. And it turned out, so the background, I have to keep going back whenever I start one of these things, and I don't know where I'll end up right when I was born. So a year before that, my wife and I had the kids to a local library on a rainy Sunday afternoon, and my wife came up to me and said, oh, I saw something I think you'd be interested in. And what it was is a poster about this Zen group meeting at Ohio State University. She knew I'd been reading Alan Watts and had read about Zen. I didn't have a clue what Zen was, but I knew it was involved black robes, sitting with your, you know, and watching candles burn. So I couldn't wait to get to this group to get a black robe and watch some candles burn. And I tried for a year, honest to God, to go to one of the meetings. And so the university's on a quarter system, and I had done some graduate work there, so I knew that, but I wasn't doing anything there at the time, and I didn't know when the quarters were. And so I'd go to a meeting, and the meetings were held in the student union. And the first time I went to one of the meetings there, well, the student union was open, but it was a quarter break and there weren't any meetings. And so then I forgot about it for a month or two. And the next time maybe I called to talk to the faculty advisor. And when I got through to him, he said, I don't know anything about the meetings. You'll have to go for yourself to find out. So then I forgot about it for another month or two. You know, that's how it went on. But something kept coming back and reminding me that there was something I wanted to check out. A year later, I finally went to one of the meetings. And instead of black robes and burning candles, what I found was a group of maybe a dozen people sitting in a circle of chairs talking. Some of the fellows had come up from the farm to try to invigorate the meetings, I think. But after I got over that little snit, I realized, oh, I'm interested in hearing what these people are talking about. I've never heard anybody talking about this before. And so I got hooked. And I started going to the meetings. And most of the, there were maybe half a dozen of the guys who had been students. I don't know if any more at the time. They had all graduated, and they'd gotten a house. They'd rented a house over in Iuka Avenue close to campus. And I would go over there two or three nights a week, and somebody would stay up and talk to me until 2 or 3 in the morning. I was just starved for this stuff, but I didn't know I was. Starved for friendship, too, because for years and years, my wife and my kids were all the friendship I wanted. I didn't think I needed other friends. But I've been missing that, you know. So anyway, the one of the first meetings, you know, after I'd gone to maybe a few of those meetings at Ohio State University, the monitor of the meeting had asked me a question of what I was thinking about on the way to the meeting. And I thought about it, and I said, well, I wasn't thinking about anything. It was springtime, and the trees were starting to bud out, and I'd always loved that. And so I said, I was just looking at the trees budding out and whatever. And then when I left the meeting that night, left the student union, I was stopped in my tracks right outside the door, and I realized, my God, I'm watching my thoughts. I didn't even know that was possible. And so in retrospect, I can see that was like the first step backwards, or, you know, within. There was something that had never been particularly in the view before, was now in the view. In fact, it was a one-way thing for me. It never stopped. I didn't go in and out of that, but I couldn't have not watched my thoughts if I'd wanted to after that, seemingly. So that was the first one I think of, and then I met Rose shortly after that, and I'd read his book. He'd written the Elgin Papers, and it was still published, and he just distributed himself in the first four chapters in 8.5 by 11 with carpet tape binding and pink or green, I forget what the cover was, and then the second four, carpet tape binding, green cover, or vice versa. And the kids there at Ohio State University weren't too methodical, so they had run out of the first half of the book, so I read the second half of the book first.
He only had money to do the second half first, so he wanted to do the important part. So once he sold enough copies of that, then he had enough money to go pay the to make another copy of the first half.
Yeah, so I remember thinking that this guy has the best humor. I'd probably read 50,000 books by then. I was a nonstop reader from the time I was a little kid. The best humor of anybody I've ever come across in my life. But he thinks he knows everything. And I was absolutely certain you couldn't know anything for sure. So I didn't see the slight contradiction in that view. And Rose's, even back then, had the four meetings a year down at the farm, and one of those was coming up, and the people in the group asked me if I wanted to go, and I said, no, I'm not interested in meeting this guy. I just like what we're doing here, blah, blah, blah. So I didn't go to the TAP meeting. And then Rose showed up unannounced at one of the meetings not too long after that. And so anyway, it'd be like me coming to the meetings there. Everybody, you know, like you don't want to exhibit yourself too much for fear that I might jump on you or whatever, tell you you're wrong and stuff like that. So the monitor didn't want to say anything, and none of the regular meeting folks. So Rose had to talk the whole meeting, and so he was talking for a while, just like he would if you were sitting around the kitchen table talking with him. He didn't have one face he presented when he was talking in public, you could say, or even in a public lecture, and another one at home. It was always Rose. And after he talked for a while, this big gong went off inside me. It was like one of those brass gongs that you see him hit with the mallets in the monastery. And the words that hit my mind were, I didn't know there was such a thing inside me, but what this fellow is saying is a truth. I've never heard it before, but something in me recognizes it. And so that's what really got me started. But the strange thing was, a couple of days later, I was wondering, what the hell was it he said that got that reaction from me? And it didn't dawn on me right away, but what it was is he said, the answers lie within. And so from the time I graduated from college, for that next 12 years, I was going in and out of these identity crises, and my mind's reaction was to look out here to see where the solution was. You know, if I got another degree, if I got bigger car, if I got whatever it was, you know. But I'd had enough of success so that I could fast forward any of those things that occurred to me, and I knew, no, that's not going to do it. And so when he said the answers are within, it opened up a whole new direction. So that's when I felt like I found my direction in life. It wasn't the answer, but it was the direction to look for the answer. So the first step back was seeing my thoughts. The second step back happened either the first or the second time I did a solitary retreat after meeting Rose. So it was either the fall of 1978 or the spring of 79. And I was staying in a little trailer on the farm. Had no heat. It was cold. It was rainy. So it was either, you know, late fall or early spring. No electricity. So, and I fasted the whole time because I didn't want to be bothered with food. I was there for a week. And after a couple days, I was cold. I was miserable. And the sun finally came out. So I went for a walk down the dirt road. There was a stream beside the road. And at one point, I saw a big boulder on the edge of the stream. The sun was shining on it. And the road and the woods between the road and the stream, there's a lot of trees, and so there wasn't much sunlight there. But I thought, oh, this would be perfect. I'll go sit on that stone and warm up in the sun. And then I remembered seeing a no trespassing sign. And I thought, oh, there's probably a hillbilly behind one of these trees with a shotgun just waiting for me to put my foot on his property. And this was the second time I was, honest to God, stopped in my tracks. I couldn't have moved if somebody put a gun to my head. And I was watching the decision-making process in slow motion. And what I saw was not too reassuring. So the fears and desires, it was like each one was a separate little idiot, and it was trying to get its way in the spotlight. And so, you know, you'd feel a fear, and what it was this idiot getting in front of the spotlight, you know. And then somebody else would push their elbow their way in. It was another fear or desire. And finally, these idiots, maybe there were a dozen of them, I don't know how many different ones I saw, but they got on two teams, and it was like a tug of war. And they were equally convincing, and that's why I think that's basically the only time we become conscious of a decision trying to get made is when there's a sort of a standoff, and it gets our attention then. We don't know whether to go right or left. And what I saw was that the side that made the most noise won the argument. So that convinced me. So I didn't need a second experience. That convinced me that I wasn't making decisions. So what I witnessed, there were no strings that I was pulling, no buttons that I was pushing. This was a program that was running.
Did you sit on a rock?
No. Nope, I didn't. So that was 78, 79, and then 10 boring years, maybe, let's see. Yeah. So a lot of stuff happened in between, but the next thing that led up to another stepping back, another going within step, was November of 1989, I'd done a solitary retreat, which ended up being the last one I did for 7 years. And and so right after that, usually after I did, and this was on Rose's farm, it was a month-long retreat. And usually after I do a retreat, if Rose was around, I'd stop in and talk to him about it. And I'd always have 1,000 things to say and 2,000 questions, you know. And but this time I didn't. And I also shortly after that, I moved my mother from where she was in New York State down to Miami, where I was living. My dad had died 4 years before that. She wasn't taking good care of herself, and so but she didn't want to move. But finally she agreed to. So I got her moved down to Miami, and then probably December, maybe late November or December sometime, I wrote a letter to Rose with all the stuff from my retreat. And I didn't hear back from him in maybe a month. And so I figured, well, it probably got lost in the mail. And I had it on my word processor, so I printed it out again, sent it back to him, sent the letter again, and didn't hear anything for a month. And at some point, I had the second intuition of my life, whatever. So to me, when I'm talking about the results of intuition, the ones I identified were the thoughts that came into my mind with great conviction. And usually any thought that occurred in my mind, I could argue six sides of the issue, you know. But every great once in a while, one would come like this one. And what came was, Rose has lost hope in me, therefore my situation's hopeless. And somebody asked me later, it might have been Paul, many years later, right? Well, didn't you check with Rose? And I remember thinking at the time, I'm in a corner here. I can't ask him, because if he'd done that intentionally, what was he going to say? Was he going to lie? Or, you know,
on the spot.
Yeah, uh-huh. And break the possible value of the trauma, you know? Or, yeah, so I felt it wasn't right to ask him, because, and even if I did, I wouldn't know whether his answer was truthful or not, because he was always truthful. But if he was doing this on purpose, maybe he'd say, no, I wasn't doing anything, yeah. So, and basically that hopelessness lasted for about 7 years. So that was early 90, and in 91 I moved to the farm from Miami to try to keep it open for people to do solitary retreats, because I placed so much value on those. I knew Rose did too. And so my values hadn't changed. I still thought that knowing what we are was the highest value that the human could struggle for. And I figured, well, if it's hopeless for me, at least maybe I can do something to help other people who still have some possibility of getting there. And so my poor mother, I moved her from Miami, then up to West Virginia. She didn't complain a bit. So that probably gets me up to something, doesn't it? So by... that had been 1990, moving to the farm in 91. So 1996, after I got my mother up to West Virginia, I was trying to find a house for her to live in. She uses a walker. She was pretty old by then. Used a walker, need everything on one floor. Mr. Rose was helping me look for houses, and none of them ever met the bill. So I ended up finally buying a house down in Moundsville, and it was trashed, and I was getting it fixed up for her. But by the time it was about 95% ready, she ended up having to go into a nursing home. So that was late 1996. And so after the November TAP meeting in 1996, I did a retreat, the first one I'd done in 7 years. And some magic things were happening. So a couple of weeks before that, I had blown the dust off Hubert Benoit's book, Supreme Doctrine. What was the subtitle of something? Psychological Studies in Zen or something like that, the English translation. And I'd read it, say, 15 years before, and I knew there was something important about it, but I didn't have a clue what it was. And so I just found myself going to the bookcase and pulling that book out of the bookcase. And it was the first time in my life, honest to God, Rose used to kid me about this. When I read a book or a newspaper, I always read from the first page to the second page to the third page, you know, through to the end. I remember one time saying, that's not the way you read a newspaper. But this was the first time in my life I ever opened a book just somewhere in the middle, you know. And I remember reading something in the middle and then maybe something toward the end. And I came across Benoit's definition. So he was a psychiatrist, but also a student of Zen. And he had a definition for acceptance. And when I read that, my mind immediately started arguing with it. So his definition of acceptance was, you look at something, say something unpleasant that's happened to you or something about yourself you don't like, and you consider with your total being whether you would change it if you had the power to do so. And I thought, holy crap, you know, to accept yourself would be to cast all this shit in concrete or in lucite maybe where somebody else can see it too. So I didn't like that idea at all. And then I brought that book with me in the solitary retreat, but I'd sort of forgotten about the acceptance argument. But the first thing I found myself doing when I got into the retreat was making a list in my journal of all these pain balloons I'd carried around with me for years, things somebody had said maybe that made me feel bad or something about myself I didn't like. And, I skipped again, contradicted my rules, I skipped down the list somewhere in the middle of the list, and I said, now let me consider this. And I don't remember anymore what the things were, but And so when I started thinking about considering that item on the list, I saw my mind go into a turbo drive that I'd never witnessed before. And it was processing information that what reminded me of is when you see in the old days debugging computer programs, you download memory and print it out. And if you were watching your display screen while it was going down, there'd be a whole screen, a whole lines and columns of hexadecimal or whatever the number based system was for the machine. These numbers just flowing by amazingly fast, and you'd spot an H6 over here or an A7 over there, something like that. But so it was like that. I was watching the mind process this tremendous load of information, and could just get little bits and pieces of it. And after some period of time, probably, I don't know, 20, 30 minutes maybe, something like that, it came to a conclusion. And the conclusion was, I don't have a big enough computer to, if I change anything, things could have come out terribly worse than they already are. And so I thought, well, that's strange. And so then I went back, and I think I picked the first item on the list, which was probably the one I had the biggest complaint about, I suppose. And my mind again went into this turbo drive kind of mentation or processing. And it was different information that it was processing, but it again came to exactly the same conclusion. And when that happened, I found myself, and this I'd experienced this before, different little satoris that had occurred. I found myself seemingly, it's like I was going up. I knew I was sitting in the chair, wherever I was at the time. But and I got an instantaneous new view. The new view, the words that came to my mind were, from up here, everything down there is perfect, just as it was and is. And when that occurred, it was like a 1,000-pound weight lifted off my shoulders. And so euphoria, it wasn't exactly euphoria, but you know, that lightness lasted for a couple months. It diminished eventually over that period, but lasted for a long time. But it surprised me because I realized I don't have to like something to accept it. Acceptance is really sort of bowing to the truth as opposed to likes and dislikes. So I don't know that acceptance experience was a going within, but it was significant in terms of the actions that were following it. So shortly after that, I started going to Pittsburgh and ended up getting a self-inquiry group set up there. So that was 1997, and that group continued on until 2013 when I left for Florida. So the next thing that occurred was really, let me back up just a little bit before that. In 2000, so that was 1997. In 2003, Sean had advised me maybe the year before that to go to a Douglas Harding retreat. He thought that might be something of value to me. And so I'd signed up for a retreat that he was going to be doing in New Jersey. I think it was at Princeton. But it turned out that summer, and it must have been in the fall, because that summer at Salisbury, he did a retreat at Salisbury every August. And he'd taken a tumble, and his doctor said, no way, you're sitting on an airplane for 7 hours, so he canceled that. And so in 2003, I wanted to go. I didn't want to go to a workshop because I'd done some of the exercise, and I thought, oh, it's going to be boring going to a workshop and doing exercise. I just want to talk to Harding. So I emailed him and asked if I could come over and spend time with him. He was like Rose. He was accessible. And so he said, sure, come on over. And the final day when I was there for maybe, I don't know, 4 days, something like that, 5 days. And the final Sunday when I was there, he got a few of the students from around the area, and they put on a little workshop for me. Can you imagine that? I was too lazy or whatever to go to a workshop, so he ends up putting one on for me. Yeah. Yeah. What teachers go through. And so one of the things that he did, his tube experiment with me. I don't know if you're familiar with Harding's tube experiment, but if you're not, look it up. You can find it on the internet. I'm sure it's under headless.org, and it's also probably YouTube versions of it available. And when he did that with me, it flipped the paradigm I've been working in for 25 years. And the paradigm I've been working in for 25 years was one that Sean, you might have mentioned it, Tess, you might have mentioned it. I know it's already been referred to, the inside-outside thing, that we're working in a dualistic dimension. So everything is going to eventually come, if you're trying to define something, it comes down to its opposite. And so in order to find yourself, Rose's, what I call Rose's paradigm was, the self is the unseen observer, viewer, experiencer, whatever, inside, the inside-outside line. Outside is anything that's in the view, anything that's experienced, anything that's known, you know. And so for 25 years, I've been pushing back. More was coming into the view. The viewer was still completely unknown, undefined. But when Harding did the tube experiment with me, all of a sudden, so his paradigm and the suggestion, you could say, that I picked up from doing the tube experiment with him, isn't anything in the view inside you. And I could see, yes, that's absolutely, as relatively, as true as the fact that I'm inside and everything in the view is outside. And so it reminded that what happened then with me after that was like what I've seen happen looking at Necker cubes. The cubes, that's only an outline, and if you stare at it, it flips inside, outside, the box, it flips inside and outside. So for at least a couple weeks after that, and especially when I, like, riding the train back from Ipswich to the airport, and in the bus station to the airport, so a place where there was a lot of people around, my mind would seemingly at will, but I wouldn't argue that, it would flip comfortably back and forth from the paradigm when everybody in the room was inside me to, no, wait a second, everybody's outside and I'm on inside. And it wasn't a great threat, seemingly, to the mind, but I would say it was the beginning of the end, because when there's an opposition like that that the mind can't resolve, it's an unsettling. So there were two views, seemingly equally valid but contradictory. And so just, you know, from the mind's logic, they can't both be true. They certainly can't be the whole story. So I went back over to see him in February 2004. A couple of the students from Pittsburgh went with me. And either on the way home from that trip or shortly thereafter, a mood descended on me. And the mood was, I want to become more serious than I've ever been in my life before. And I'd had the long-standing conviction that if anything was ever going to happen, I'd have to be on my own, because my mind didn't relax enough around people. And so my thought was, when that mood descended on me, I kept my mental fingers crossed that it would last until May, when I had a solitary retreat scheduled. And in retrospect, it was the stupidest thing I could have done to procrastinate that mood when it came down. But it did last until May, and when I got in the solitary retreat. So my experience in that retreat was similar to the pattern was like what Tess was talking about. I went through the retreat. It was a week, and the night of the final day of the retreat, that evening, I'd saved to go down. It was on Lake Erie, and I walked down to the lake and watched the sunset over the lake, and came back, and I was just sitting in my chair, nothing more to do. I was thinking, well, it's been another wonderful retreat, but no solution. And then what had been occurring for a few days, the final few days of the retreat, was the words open sesame would just come to my mind out of nowhere many times a day. And when that would happen, I'd find myself looking back at what I was looking out for, the Harding experiment. And up until that point, I saw nothing when I looked back there. But this final night, sitting in the chair, when I looked back, what I saw was awareness. And eventually, as I stared at it, I saw awareness as self-aware. And to me, this was all the intuition processing this data that was coming in. And the next thing that occurred is, it doesn't need my help to be self-aware, you know. So that was me looking out. That was awareness, right? It was self-aware, and it didn't need my help being aware. But then, flag goes up, wait a second, I believe I'm the separate awareness over here that's watching awareness be aware and doesn't need my help. Yeah, and so that was the way the final opposition tumbled into my mind. And the resolution was, I saw very clearly that Art Titner never was. And the way I'd say it is, the final resistance in my mental circuitry burned out, my mind opened to the truth. And I have no idea how to explain either to myself or to you about how the mind shares in this realization, but when you know what you are, you're beyond the mind. and yet somehow the mind picks it up in this space, which it hadn't done. So I was beyond the mind every night when I was in deep sleep, but I'd wake up in the morning and my mind didn't know it, you know, my conscious mind.
And you pulled the plug in on yourself.
Yeah, yeah. So what was going on? I made a parallel list of things that were going on during those years. In retrospect, I think it was all intuition. But the first was losing identity as a thinker. So when I saw here, I'm stopped in my tracks and I realized I'm watching my thoughts. And so I wasn't making these thoughts. You know, I didn't have a little pen and paper and was writing those thoughts down anywhere. They were coming out of nowhere and I was watching them. So I lost, the first thing was losing my identity with a thinker. And then the next time when I saw the decision-making process in slow motion, that basically lost my identification with the decision maker. And a lot of this stuff, I think it's cumulative more. It's like, it may not be 100% because you realize anything you think you know is questionable, but it's enough to convince the jury, you could say. So it loosens the identification or the faulty self definition. The next one after that was somehow, and this was more not as clear. So sometimes, like, when you study algebra and finally you figure out that what x the unknown, what that's all about, you may not see, it may just creep up on you, and you may not see any clear dividing line when before you knew it and after you knew it. And so the next loss of identity, it was more like that, and that was as the doer. So some combination of watching, knowing I was watching thoughts, I wasn't making thoughts, I was watching thoughts, and then a bunch of other things like who is that psychologist back in the 70s who was doing experiments with students where they'd try to identify when they became aware they were going to move their finger or something like that. Libet, wasn't it? Benjamin Libet? Yeah. So and that stuff is still getting updated by neurologists. But, you know, I'd read stuff about how whenever the hand moves, there's a signal that's been sent from some part of the brain to the muscle. And we don't even become aware that the signal is sent until after it's already been sent, but then there's a little space where you can countermand it. So when you become aware that I'm getting ready to punch you in the face, I still got a veto, half a second or something like that. So a lot of that stuff, I think, contributed to it. But so I lost the identity as the doer, which is a problem then, because when you know pretty sure you're not the doer, and yet you still feel, well, I've got to do something. I don't do anything, you know, that would be stupid. The next thing was losing identity as a person. I was talking to Meg about that a little bit earlier, and I don't know exactly what all triggered that, but it became intuitively obvious to me, like what X the unknown was for algebra, eventually that the personality was a mask. I could see it out here and had been complaining about it and, you know, bragging about it and complaining about it for 40 or 50 years, something like that. But I could see it, since it was in the view, it obviously wasn't me. And then the final thing that occurred was the loss of identification as an individual something. So the other thing I wanted to talk about is this idea of resistance to truth. And I came across something recently about insulin resistance that I thought was a worthy similarity to talk about this. So insulin resistance, from what I read, my version of it was ordinarily we've got about 5 grams of... So glucose is what feeds the cells in the body. And glucose is soluble in water, so it goes very rapidly to the cells, and the cells can take it in, eat with ease. And so ordinarily we've got about 5 grams of glucose in our bloodstream. But if you eat... So where is... My reminder, yeah. So Cass has something there that has a lot of glucose in. That's an energy bar, so it's not exactly a candy bar, but so that's like an ounce and a half, something like that, right? So a half ounce candy bar has somewhere between maybe 10 and 15 grams of glucose equivalent. And so if you eat that, you've immediately like quadrupled the amount of sugar in your bloodstream. And if that doesn't change rapidly, you're going to be in a pre-diabetic condition. And so the pancreas creates insulin. Insulin tells some doors on the cells to open up, and those doors are called glucose transporters. But sometimes the insulin shoots into the bloodstream, the cells get the cell doors get the message and they don't respond.
No, can't do it anymore.
Apparently, yeah. And then the pancreas apparently creates more insulin to try to convince the guys, and you know, and so the medical profession apparently calls that insulin resistance. Yeah. And so the question that brings up in my mind is, well, why won't those doors open up? You know, what's the story? And the same thing in terms of the mind opening up. Why won't the mind, right now, why won't the mind open up to capital T truth, to capital S self? You know? And so looking back on my life, an explanation that occurs to me is that, so I've died three times in my life, and each time I had a different experience. And so the first time, I was about maybe 10 years old. It was late winter. My dad and I went, he and some of his buddies had a hunting camp an hour or two north of where we lived. And he wanted to get out of the house. So we went up and we skied through, this was like a farm, you know, so there was a lot of property there. And there was a certain spot he wanted to check where the deer spent time, I guess. You know, he wanted to see if the deer were surviving the winter. So we had skis and snowshoes, and I was never, not anymore, but was lazy. And I didn't want a snowshoe because that's a lot of work. So I said, yeah, let's put the skis on. So we skied into this place, and at one point we got into a place that might have been a swamp, I don't know, but we were up to our armpits in snow. Wow. And struggled. And finally, I just said, Dad, I can't do this anymore. I have no memory of what happened. And the next memory was finding myself back in the car.
3 minutes, all
right. Okay. Yeah, so at that point, I faced death, and what did I get? Nothing, blackness, you know, no picture. The second time I faced death was when I moved to Los Angeles. I went for a swim in the Pacific Ocean. Never heard of riptides, but I got caught in one. And as soon as I felt myself being dragged out to Hawaii, I thought, I don't want to go there, so I started flailing with my arms and legs, and pretty soon they stopped working. I mean, it was like the muscles became spaghetti. And I thought, this is it. And when I did, I surprised myself then. I still surprised thinking about it. So I'd been terrorized when I was trying to flail, you know, and keep from being pulled out to sea. And when I gave up, I just relaxed. And then I lost body consciousness, and I had a life review, like you hear about in the sailors drowning, near-drowning experiences. And so in the life review, it was like... my life was laid out on a flat surface, and I was traveling. I was like an eye, or like a binocular, or something like that. And no, a monocular, a telescope kind of thing. I was just coming over this up this tree trunk from the older experiences to the newer experiences. And each branch, I had the feeling that I could go down any branch I wanted to if I wanted to see more information about any of those experiences. I didn't take the options. So I don't know if that was true or not. But I came up to the most recent experiences, and then the next thing I was feeling my knees dragging in the sand. And when I came back to consciousness, I was way up the beach from where I'd started. Yeah. So that was the second, what I would call phase, the mind being convinced that death was there, you know. And in that case, I got a life review. And then the third time was in that solitary retreat. And I think the difference was what my mind knew about what my self-definition was. So I think enough of it had been pared away so that the mind was able to open all the way. At that point, there was nothing left to hang on to. Once I saw that Art Titner never was, you know, once that individuality conviction dropped off. Let us pray.
I heard that drowning is a peaceful experience.
They sure left me not being afraid of it. It would be a nice way to go, I think. Of course, the other strange thing is why I didn't get water in my lungs, isn't it?
Yeah, maybe your body was, you lost consciousness, but your body still had enough intelligence in
Kept my mouth shut.
Kept my mouth shut and weren't breathing, so you weren't mm-hmm. sucking in water.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe a dolphin carried you in.
Could be. mm-hmm.
Yeah. Maybe even face up and then got turned around when you were on the beach.
No, I woke, when I came back to consciousness, I was still this, you know,
yeah, you
tummy down. Oh, when I was being carried over. Maybe. There are many possibilities, aren't there? So I get to sit down now, don't I?